And good afternoon. My name is Amy Toy. I'm the host of Angel Answers, and we have a, I have a special guest today, David Salisbury. He is going to talk about his book, which is a very good book if you want to know about witchcraft. It's called The Deep Heart of Witchcraft, Expanding the Core of Magical Practice. And he's going to be talking about that, and he's a very in-depth practitioner of witchcraft, and he... David is a Wiccan clergy within the Coven of the Spiral Moon, and that's a coven based in Washington, D.C., and he's a teacher of different rituals. Like I said, he's doing a great job with this book here. Welcome, David. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming on the show. This book is very in-depth, and we're going to talk about different elements, and we only have an hour, so I'm just going to ask you a few questions, if you don't mind. Tell us about, you know, I like to have people talk about their path and how they came to this, so how did you come to the path of being a witch?
Well, I kind of stumbled upon it very early on, when I was about 12 years old, based on kind of different factors. I had a stepmother at the time who was kind of dabbling, and then I had a schoolmate whose mother was a Wiccan high priestess, and I had befriended the schoolmate without knowing any of that, and then, of course, over the course of hanging out at their house, you know, the family shares a little bit about what they do, and it just really interested me at the time.
Yeah, it is very interesting, and when I'm going to give you some questions about the basics in case people don't know about the pentagram and all that stuff. So
yeah,
how did you arrive at writing this book, The Deep Heart of Witchcraft? How did you arrive to that? It's always interesting how people, you know, arrive to writing, you know, coming to writing a book or something of this caliber, especially.
Yeah, it actually came about almost by accident in a way. I teach classes on Wicca and witchcraft here in the D.C. area with some other teachers in my tradition. And, you know, over the years, course material grows and it changes based on feedback that you get from students and, you know, from the teachers who are providing the material. And over time, we realized that people were coming to the tradition craving a little more than what is usually presented. So we tried to craft a lot of our material to kind of push people, to challenge people, to encourage folks to take pretty much whatever they're presented with and take it a layer deeper. So as I began to kind of revise our teaching material, I started having pages and pages of notes and essays and things like that. And I said, well, I might as well just put it all in under one cover.
Yeah, it looks like that. Wow, you're very well versed in a lot of, I learned a lot in that, you know, I consider myself pretty well read with different things, but I learned a lot. Yeah, I definitely did. Why would someone be drawn to practicing witchcraft?
I find that most people I know who are drawn to witchcraft come to it from a feeling of being called. It's a calling in a way. People say that once they find it, they feel like they've come home. It feels very natural to them. And I think part of it is the very naturalistic aspect to it. Now, I think that there's a lot of people in this day and age who are waking up to, you know, a lot of the environmental challenges on the planet and war and disease and all of that stuff, and people are kind of craving nature a little more, and not just nature kind of on the surface level of what we can see and touch, but, you know, the spirit that animates all of those different aspects of nature. And people find that once they kind of look at life through that lens, they can get a lot of, you know, personal empowerment from it. That can really change their lives.
Yeah, I think we are getting back to the basics, and that's what I call it, you know, getting back to nature, getting back to the basics of everything. We overanalyze things. Now we want to get back to the basics, so that's really cool. So what is the difference between candle magic versus, you know, witchcraft or Wiccan practices?
You could say that candle magic is a function within witchcraft, certainly there's a lot of different methods and modalities to raise energy and call energy and send it out. Candle magic is probably one of those things that a lot of spiritual traditions have, even if they don't call it candle magic. You know, of course, like my grandmother always has candles to the saints burning on her dresser with, you know, rosaries around it. And that to me is an altar with magical candles on it. But we just have different language to describe it.
Yeah, when I was reading the book, you brought up Catholic like I was. So it's like you go to the church and there's candles all over the place. You know, you could light a candle with the intention of maybe, you know, someone's sick or something like that. So it's all about intention. Where
absolutely.
Wiccan is more involved and in depth. As you know, when you pick up the book, you'll see the rituals that are involved. What's the purpose of a ritual, in your opinion?
In my opinion, ritual has, I think it depends on the type of ritual. Ritual really can serve a lot of different functions. Primarily, it should always be shifting something or changing something. You know, ritual is so deeply ingrained in human consciousness. You know, we all have our little rituals, quote unquote, as we move throughout the day. And the purpose of ritual in witchcraft is to kind of focus and hone our intention in a way that kind of maximizes the effect of what we're putting our intention into. An example of that would be, you know, if you're doing healing work for someone, and you know, you might send them a prayer, send them good energy. But if you're doing that in a ritual focus, you're calling on energy to kind of shape the situation, the ritual becomes kind of a container for that energy, and it sends it out in a more focused way.
Okay.
And I think that that's probably one of the biggest functions. And of course, there's other purposes of ritual and witchcraft, like marking rites of passage, or when someone gets initiated into one of the degrees.
And throughout the book, I've heard the neo-pagan. What is that exactly? What does that mean, neo-pagan?
Yeah, a neo-pagan. Well, paganism is interesting because, of course, it has very ancient roots. You know, a lot of different pagan traditions that go very far back, you know, into ancient polytheism. But most pagans today practice a kind of syncretic blending of old methods and new things put together. So that's why most pagans usually kind of like to refer to themselves as neo-pagans, unless they're practicing some kind of what we would call a reconstructionist polytheistic religion, you know, which is someone who is looking at the belief system and core mythos of a culture and trying to reconstruct that as best they can without much variation.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now let's go into some of the basics. You know, what is a pentagram?
The pentagram is the most identifiable symbol and tool in witchcraft and in Wicca, and it's the five-pointed star with the circle around it. I say it's a tool and a symbol because it has a symbolic function and it has a ritual function too. Each 5 points of the star represent a certain element, earth, air, fire, and water, with the top point representing spirit. The circle around it represents the ever-changing course of humanity and nature through birth, life, death, you know, the cycle of life. The circle could also be seen as what binds all of those elements together so that they're working together in harmony. And it's a very misaligned symbol, you know. And certainly in the what's called the satanic panics of the 80s, the pentagram was getting thrown around a lot in a lot of, you know, cult crime cases and things like that. So, and of course, you know, the death metal movement and all of that, you know, musicians will use it with their bands and all of that, but You know, it's really just a benign, powerful tool for transformation. You know, we use it in ritual to call on and focus the elements, to attune our bodies with it, to bring that energy into the space of the circle. And many witches like to wear it as a pendant to either represent their faith or as an active talisman to kind of keep those elements close to the heart.
Okay. Well, thank you for explaining the satanic panic.
Yeah.
I have never heard that phrase. That's great. I love it.
That was an interesting time, and I think that because of that era, the pentagram will never be fully understood or accepted by a lot of people, or if it is, it'll probably take quite a while. But you know, there's other symbols that some pagans use and some witches use that are a lot more common even than the pentagram that most people wouldn't look twice at. Like the spiral is one of our most sacred and powerful symbols. And the triple goddess symbol, the symbol which is a full moon flanked by two crescent moons to represent the three faces of the goddess and of womanhood. There's a lot of symbols connected to things, some well-known like the pentagram, others not so much.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I just thought I'd ask about that because there is so many misconceptions, and the reason why I have this show is so I can educate people on the misconceptions and maybe, you know, break some of that stuff. The satanic panic, I love that. It's great. No, I remember that, actually.
Really? There was a lot of, funny misconceptions that grew out of that, but, you know, it was also a really terrible time for a lot of people. I mean, you know, that all happened way before I ever became involved in witchcraft, and, you know, certainly the legitimate witches of the time, you know, had to be really careful about, you know, waving a pentagram around or, you know, talking to their neighbors about what they did. You know, there's families who lost custody of children, you know, during that time, just for faith practices. So, I think it's really important that we kind of take symbols like that that have been maligned through history and kind of reclaim them for those reasons. And that's purposefully why I choose to wear a pentagram every day, to work, to the grocery store, everywhere. And I usually don't get many negative comments, but occasionally I do, and it's always an opportunity to have a conversation.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, that's good. You know, education is very good, and I don't think ignorance is really bliss here. So.
Yeah.
You know, yes, exactly. So I'm going to go through the different elements that you talk about, and you could just briefly describe them however you wish. Okay. So I'll just educate people.
Great.
And like I said, you know, how can we use the element of air, and what is it? You know, in your tell me. Okay.
Yeah. Well, when we look at the element of air, we're looking at all things mercurial. So that would be inspiration, insight, clarity, vision, all of those things that we see as coming in on the wind. And when witches work with air, we're calling on, you know, the physical element itself, but, you know, of course, the spirit behind it. So, you know, in the book, I talk about, you know, beings that are associated with air, like, you know, certain types of fae creatures and other beings that kind of represent the element. We call them elementals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would call upon those beings for clarity and vision and all of that. Air is governed by the eastern quarter, you know, the direction of east. In circle witches acknowledge the four directions in most traditions, and east is primarily associated with air, and that's the first direction that we approach when we call those directions and the elements in. So air is really the initiator in that sense. Since it's the first element we acknowledge, it really sets up the space for everything else to come in. You know, it's blowing everything away that's not serving us, and it blows in, you know, the positive, new, fresh energy.
I like that. Anything to get all that hot air out of there, you know.
Yes. Yeah, sometimes, and you know, if you do outdoor ritual, a lot of people who are new to public ritual are amazed by the act of calling air in the east. Oftentimes, a gust of wind will come up out of nowhere, or will flow around the circle area, you know, almost inexplicably on a very otherwise calm day. So yeah, I mean, these elemental powers have a very real presence when you call them.
Yes, they do. Now, how can we use the element of fire, which I know you're a Leo, and I'm a moon in Leo.
okay. So you know a little bit about fire then.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, fire is the element of the heart and the blood. So it's everything that governs passion, vision in more of the psychic sense rather than the physical sense. Fire is it's an initiator in a way, because it's the cleansing element. A lot of people think of water as a cleansing element, but fire is the most aggressive of them. So yeah, you know, it's an element of very strong, immediate, rapid change and transformation. And in the book, when we talk about fire, I like to use the allegory of the forge. You know, you're putting the metal of your soul into the fire for the goal of it being softened, so that you can meld it into something better. You know, burning away all that doesn't serve you and allowing kind of your inner gold to shine. And that's what fire really does for us at its core, I think.
I feel so too. Yes, I've got all those elementals going on there, you know, fire.
So. Yeah, I mean, I think most people would venture to say that if they've ever gone through a time of really rapid change that felt really difficult, like, you know, they were just walking through fire, that phrase, they'll often say that process led them to a state that was so much more clear, so much more bright than they originally started. So yeah, I think there's another great example of a very real thing that fire does, you know, in the spiritual aspect. You know, I don't recommend walking through physical fire anytime.
No, there's that saying too, trial by fire, you know.
And yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it sounds like you and I, yeah, we've been through the fire a few times. Didn't want to go there, but we had to go there. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the fire was, I don't think I talked about this in the book, but fire was an element that I struggled with for a long time. I felt like throughout my witchcraft training, fire was kind of the last element that I felt like I was able to get a strong connection with, which sounds like it would be surprising, right, because I'm a Leo and I have lots of fire signs in my chart. But yeah, I think in the end, it was because fire ended up having a lot to teach me about being aggressive in a positive way, being assertive, all those things that I wasn't really great at doing as a kid. So I was kind of subconsciously avoiding it out of fear. And I've talked to other people about that experience when they work spiritually with fire. But, you know, if you face it with bravery and courage, which are aspects of fire, it's almost like you're taking that risk, that leap into the flames, and fire kind of rewards you in that way.
Yeah, like facing your fears head on instead of running from them. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, fire, and the south is the direction that's associated with fire, and the fire guardians do not appreciate cowardice when you approach them. Yeah.
Yeah, they don't. Yeah. And how about the element of air, or water, I'm sorry, water. What about water? How can we use water? I'm a Pisces, my sun sign, but I got water, fire,
great.
Air, and no earth.
Yeah, water is the element that I had probably the easiest time with growing up a little bit, because I'm very sensitive and emotional, and water governs sensitivity, emotion, everything lunar. So everything that the moon is in charge of, water is in charge of. You know, the moon controls the flow of the tides, and so everything associated with the moon pretty much is associated with water. So intuition is a feature of water. the ability to flow, you know, which is a fun word to associate with water. But, you know, when we talk about our ability to flow like water, we're talking about kind of following the course of our desire. You know, trust, again, is another big thing with water. You have to go with the flow and trust that, you know, something will be around the bend. It might be a waterfall, or it might be a gentle little stream. So, you know, water can have its ups and downs, just as fire does. But working with water is spiritually, in witchcraft, is mostly about bringing up those emotional parts of you that would probably rather stay hidden, and it brings them to light. So in a way, a lot of people struggle with connecting with water and witchcraft, because our overculture wants to tell us that feelings are not as valid or important as intellect and knowledge. And certainly for, you know, Americans and men in particular, I know that, you know, we're taught that emotion is something that we should only show if we absolutely have to, and be quick about it if you do. So water, especially for men, can be a really powerful tool to use, because it brings up all those feelings and it transforms them. And that's an important thing to bring up, actually, for folks who are kind of wondering, oh, what makes witchcraft a little different spiritually, and how we, you know, face challenges and fears. Mm-hmm. In a lot of, you know, Eastern practices with water, the goal is to cleanse bad feelings, bad memories, you know, pain, cleanse it all away. Mm-hmm. In witchcraft, it's kind of the opposite. We acknowledge the dark parts of ourselves that are hurting, that are in pain, that have anger, and we don't want to cleanse them away, because it's all power, and it's all part of our bodies and ourselves, and we think that all of us, all of our parts are important and sacred. So the goal with water is to kind of bring all of that up to the surface and transform it and call it back to us.
Oh, okay.
So, cool. Yeah, it sounds cool. Also really hard in
yeah.
a lot of ways, but I mean, people can start small with cleansing things with water. In the tradition that I work under, which is called Fairy, there's a tool called Kala, and it involves taking a cup of water and projecting, you know, your negative feelings of the day or the week or the month into the water, and turning it black like a poison with your mind. And the second step is going back to the water and charging it with light and with, you know, every positive thing that, you know, has happened to you or that you can recall in your mind. And then you drink it down.
Mm.
And it sounds like a really simple practice, but it's that tool has actually been one of the most transformational practices I've ever experienced in the craft. So there's something that folks can try right now if they want.
Cool, yeah. You know, as a woman, anger is like our thing. You know, we're not supposed to feel angry. And, you know,
yep.
That's one of my life path is anger. So that'd be, you know, that's good to acknowledge that. And someone said to me a long time ago, just acknowledge the anger and just, you know, it's part of you. You know, and I'm like, really? I don't want it part of me. I want it gone. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in that sense, you know, the another thing about witchcraft and also a lot of what we call the Western magical traditions, you know, the goal not being to cleanse anything away. We recognize the fact that religion to us isn't, you know, religion, spiritual practice for us, it's not meant to separate us from our bodies or from the world. The goal for us is to put us firmly in the middle of it and to experience mm-hmm. everything it has to offer. So what we do with feelings like anger is we say, okay, you know, big fits of rage are, you know, usually not helpful when they come up. But instead of, you know, banishing it, we're going to look deep into the core of, you know, what sparked that anger. That way, next time it comes up, it doesn't, you know, throw us into, you know, a wild, uncontrollable state. Because, you know, anger is one of those things where once you get going, it's kind of hard to ramp yourself down from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have no idea. How can we use the element of earth? How about the earth? How can we The Earth is great. I actually like this chapter for me.
Yeah, I love writing the chapter on Earth. I think it's one of the longer chapters because Earth is wisdom and it's stability. It's where everything begins and returns to. So it's very important. All the other elements live on Earth, obviously. But primarily when we work with Earth as an element rather than, you know, as the planet as a whole, we're looking at its ability to nurture, to take things in. So there's that aspect of gestation. Earth is considered one of the dark elements. You know, water is a dark element, and Earth is a dark element. And Earth's darkness is very healing because, you know, the seed needs that gestation point in darkness or else it's not going to sprout up. And it's not going to take root. So that's what Earth does for us. It gives us a stable foundation for us to put our roots into. And then once we have our roots down, we can take in nourishment. We can have a strong starting point. Mm-hmm. You know, working with Earth spiritually, I mean, at its core is as simple as going outside and hugging a tree. You know, it sounds really, really silly. You know, people make fun of the tree huggers, you know, the hippies and all of that. But there's a reason why that is a very well-known practice. You know, you hug a tree, you are literally pressing your skin against the bark. You're having that kind of physical connection. Earth is all about physical. You know, so when we work with Earth, we prefer to touch it in our hands. You know, when we have Earth in a circle, we'll usually have a bowl of salt or pebbles or crystals or stones, and we'll pass them around the circle, or at least we do in our tradition, to kind of remind us that we're here and that it's good that we're here and that we're blessed to be on a planet like this.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Now, you talk about stones in that chapter, too, a little bit, and that's important, too, in ritual, correct, with the stones?
Yes. Mm-hmm. There are different, you know, traditions of witchcraft place different focus on the importance of stones. I think that stones have a lot to teach us spiritually. Some would look at stones as kind of you know, like recipe ingredients, like a recipe and a spell. Oh, add the stone with the stone, you get this effect. I like to take the approach that each stone has its own animating spirit behind it. So the spirit of an amethyst is going to be very different from the spirit of the quartz. And what most people, you know, particularly say in the New Age movement, will work with a stone specifically for kind of the symptoms or the vibrations that it gives off. In witchcraft, we do that, but our primary concern is, you know, if I'm picking up an amethyst crystal and I'm looking to work with it, I'm going to, you know, psychically connect with the animating spirit behind that amethyst crystal and all amethyst crystals. So there's a microcosm and a macrocosm of spirits all involved with each stone. And I love that because, you know, if you're surrounded by stone, it's by stones, you know, you're surrounding yourself with really unique individual earth spirits. So, you know, you're never alone in that sense.
Exactly.
That's why whenever I travel, I always have a little pouch of stones, and because you never know when you can use a tiger's eye spirit for some protection or some bravery or some hematite to calm and relax you. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool.
And stones. Yes, stones, a thing that folks should be careful about, I would say, when they work with stones is I like to encourage people to not have them become a crutch because, say, stones for grounding and protection, if you are kind of flighty a little bit, which I can get that way sometimes, if I have a lot going on and, you know, my brain starts lapsing, and I have a grounding stone with me, it's important that I use it in that moment. And then I also, on the long term, incorporate practices that kind of permanently ground me. You know, tools that are kind of built into my body rather than with something outside of me. Because I think a lot of us, you know, in New Age or spirituality movements, no stone collectors mm-hmm. whose homes will be filled with stones, thousands, tens of thousands of dollars worth of stones and geodes and crystals. But it's a crutch in a way. You know, if you took all their stones away, they wouldn't have any other tools to use. So that's something to think about, too. Earth, where it provides us a good, stable foundation, but if you become uprooted too quickly and you have that physicality taken away from you, then you have to make sure that you have systems in place that are built in to move you forward.
Huh, interesting. Yeah, I just saw that in the Earth chapter. Now we're going to go into the element of spirit. How can we use that? Because that was another cool chapter. I work with spirit, obviously. So.
Yeah. Yes, spirit is really debated about in witchcraft. Yes. You know, what its function is, what it is. I mean, at its core, people can think of spirit like they do chi. Most people have heard of chi or mana. Which is just, you know, primal life force energy. I believe you're a Reiki practitioner, so, you know, you could see the Reiki energy is spirit. It comes from spirit. It is spirit. Spirit is the top point on the pentagram, and it's in that position because whereas we say all of the elements come from Earth and, you know, they all go back to Earth, spirit is where Earth comes from. So it really, it's the point of origin. You know, before Earth, you know, we were just dust, we were stardust, and that's what spirit represents. And when we work with spirit, we're working with basically that raw life force energy. There's spirit within each element, and there's spirit that is etheric, you know, meaning that it's not, you know, tied to anything physical. So you know, if you're holding a flame, you know, a candle with a flame, you know, there's spirit energy around that flame. But when the flame goes away, you can call up the element of fire by using spirit as kind of a proxy. Does that make sense?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So spirit is of great help because, you know, it's everywhere and in everything at all times. So, you know, we are never lacking in spirit.
Exactly.
So it's a great tool.
It is. It really is. And I thought that was a good chapter, too, with working with spirit. And it was very in-depth, which is good because that's, you go into different, you know, the gods. Let's go into the gods and goddesses a little bit here. Why do you, the goddess energy, you talk about, what is it,
Maiden, Mother, and Crone?
Crone, yep. Mm-hmm. The three elements.
Yeah.
The triple.
Yeah, the triple goddess. The image of the maiden, mother, and crone comes primarily from Wicca.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a way to categorize, in a way, the goddess, who's the primal creator energy in a lot of witchcraft traditions. The maiden, of course, is the kind of first stage of the goddess. She's represented in the moon when it is waxing. So when it's mm-hmm. growing from new to full, the mother is middle stage, and that's represented by the full moon. And then, of course, the crone is the end stage, where the moon is going from full to dark and then to new, where things are decreasing. And we honor the goddess specifically in those categories because we believe that there's power behind every stage in life. The young youth, kids, children, babies, they have a very strong personal power of their own. And, you know, so do the elderly have their own unique, specific energy that they bring to the table, as well as the people in between. And it's really important to us to identify those stages because, again, the overculture either spends a lot of time attacking youth, or it spends a lot of time attacking the elderly.
Exactly.
So, yeah, you know, you're not worthy unless you're kind of right in that middle stage. And then, you know, as soon as parts of the body start to go, then, you know, so does your sanity, you know.
Yeah, really.
Especially with women, there's that view, you know, oh, elderly women, they're just oh, she doesn't know what she's talking about. She's old and senile and all of that. And you know, the crone is represented by wisdom, you know, because we can have the youthful vitality of the maiden. You know, she births spring. She brings us new life. But life can't continue without the crone, because she turns back to the maiden after her time is up. So, you know, it's all a cycle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And we got to move along here, our time, because there's so much material to cover. It's a wonderful book to really get into the depths of, you know, witchcraft and Wicca. And it was something that was interesting I want to get on before we move on to other things, is why is it so difficult for some to connect with God, not the goddess element? God, you mentioned, is poet, father, and sage. Why do you think it's so difficult for some?
I think primarily, when I talk to witches who have difficulty connecting with male deity energy, I find that a lot of it comes from people who come from really fractured Judeo-Christian backgrounds, where the male god is seen as angry, jealous, full of rage, you know, all of those images. That's not to say that that's, you know, the prime symbolism in Christianity. I don't want to stereotype that religion at all, but some people they have that perception, or they get that experience from that background a lot. Especially if they come from, you know, an evangelical upbringing or a Southern Baptist upbringing, you know, our God is a jealous God, that whole thing. So when they come to Wicca and witchcraft, they find the goddess who is, you know, strong and sovereign, and has, you know, a rageful quality to her, you know, in some of the crone aspects, but overall she's peaceful, compassionate, loving, nurturing. So it almost feels like a relief for people. So then when it's time to look at the masculine divine, some either want to consider it less than, or something that they don't want to work with at all. And there's actually whole traditions in witchcraft that don't recognize the god at all. You know, Dianic witchcraft.
I've heard of that, yes.
Yeah. And I think having kind of that strong balance of god and goddess is a big priority in Wicca. But in a lot of witchcraft traditions, it's not entirely necessary in a lot of ways, because it's that whole idea of, you know, there's god in every part of the goddess, there's goddess in every part of the god anyway. So some witches don't like to divide things up that evenly. Mm-hmm. You know, you see that in, here's another really striking, polarizing image. There's a god called the Baphomet, whereas if you look up kind of devil symbolism, you know, that the older culture likes to paint witchcraft with, you'll see this image of a goat-horned being with cloven hooves and a big pentagram through his horns, and there's a torch behind him. It's a very imposing image, but the Baphomet is really the union of the god and the goddess. Baphomet has female features like breasts, and then also male features as well. So Baphomet represents the fact that, you know, the divine is both and neither all at the same time. So, and I think a lot of people have trouble understanding that, because people have a lot of issues understanding their own gender identity and where, you know, masculinity and feminine energy, how that plays a role in society today. So some people are like, well, I haven't even figured it out completely on my own, so how am I going to attempt to figure it out with the divine? But you know, I think the best way for people to start, you know, unwrapping how they view the divine, you know, with the genders, is to just approach the gods, talk to them, you know, say, who are you? What are you about? You know, what's your gender like? Is it, you know, is it important? Do you not care? You know, because I mean, some gods in the mythologies will change their gender at will randomly. So.
Oh yes. And real quick, where our time is, like I said, we've got so much material here. That's why people need to pick up the book. I'll learn a lot. You know, seriously, they need to really pick it up. You talk about the different cycles. Is it Sabbath? Sabbat? I don't know.
Yeah, the Sabbath.
Sabbat and,
mm-hmm.
and Sam.
You could say it either way.
Samhain.
Samhain.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. There's
yeah, what's a little
well,
bit about
not,
that? Yeah.
Well, I'll try to be brief. The Sabbaths are holidays, and in most forms of witchcraft, there's 8 of them, and they're fairly evenly divided into what we call the wheel of the year. So there's the 2 equinoxes, the 2 solstices, and then there are what we call the high holy days in between each of them, making for 8. And the Sabbaths mark the cycle of the seasons, as well as the birth, growth, and death of the god and his relationship to the goddess. And originally they were came from harvest festivals primarily and ways to kind of plan for, you know, planting season, growing season, harvest season. And then in modern witchcraft, we like to kind of internalize the Sabbaths. You know, so on Yule, which is, you know, you could call it the pagan Christmas, you know, it's winter solstice, that's when the sun is born. It's the, you know, the days start to grow longer after the winter solstice. So we look at those dark parts inside of us and see what needs to have some light shed on it. And we work to grow that light within us. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, when you get to, you know, the other end of the wheel on Samhain, which is around October 31st, that's the day when, you know, the god is seen as, you know, dying. He's, you know, the god of the wheat who passes into the underworld so nature can be reborn again at Yule. So on Samhain, we look to our ancestors and we honor them and lay offerings. So it's, you know, a far cry from what most people celebrate as Halloween today. But, you know, if you look at traditions like Dia de los Muertos in Mexico, they do things that are very similar to modern-day witchcraft celebrations for Samhain. You know, having picnics for the ancestors and loved ones, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Huh, okay. Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah, and when you go through the whole, you know, the Sabbats or whatever, and it's really cool because you take us through a progression, like Ostara would be our Easter, wouldn't it? Or the Easter for the pagan, for the Christian. Yeah.
The funny thing about Easter is that it actually is a very pagan way of being placed on the calendar. It's always mm-hmm. the first Sunday after the first full moon after Ostara.
Yeah, isn't that cool how...
Yeah.
The Christian, you know, it just was really cool because I was like, I remember that from, you know, history class, you know, the different holidays or the holy days and everything. And when we're putting this all together for people, how would they start out maybe? Like, what would you suggest? Do they start out with just the elements in the book or do they just, you know, because some of the stuff I could relate to because I practiced some of it myself and some I couldn't.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I try to make it a complete system that someone in a witchcraft frame of reference can work under, but obviously there's a lot of things in there that really anyone can pick up and do. You know, you can just go to any of the exercises and, you know, say, you know, doing a grounding exercise, anyone can do that, you know. And
oh, yeah, I need grounding all the time.
Don't we all? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And practices like that, you know, witchcraft doesn't own that. You know, that's part of a lot of different traditions. So if people are, you know, very new to the idea of craft and are kind of cautious based on, you know, kind of the loaded imagery that people are brought up with, you know, new practices like grounding, meditation, breath. I mean, some of this stuff is, you know, boring in a lot of ways. And I think that's why a lot of young people pick it up really quickly and then put it back down after they realized how much work it is. Because, I mean, most of my daily practice is just sitting in front of my altar, breathing. It's really,
yeah, really,
not, it's really
yeah.
not all, it's not all that excited, you know.
Yeah.
You think of, like, the witch next door, you imagine them over a bubbling cauldron and saying, you know, long incantations in Latin. And sure, I do that sometimes, but, you know, 90% of the time I'm just breathing.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's and it's about connecting, like you said, to the earth and everything. And where can people pick up your book? Where can they get? Is it out? Is it out yet? Because you gave me a copy. Is it out yet?
Yeah. It's out. It got released early, actually, so it's been out for a few weeks now, and it's on Amazon and the Barnes & Noble website, and hopefully, if folks have a local metaphysical shop in their area, then they might be carrying it as well.
Great, and I am sorry to cut you on time. Would you mind coming back on the show at some point and going further into, if you wouldn't mind, about what, this is interesting, I loved it. I just have to go, I have an emergency that I have to take care of, but if you don't mind, would you mind coming back on?
Oh, I'd love to. I had a blast.
Yeah, me too. I really appreciate it. I'm sorry to cut you short. I had a call that I have to take, and it's an emergency. So thank you so much, David. I appreciate everything. Keep in touch, and definitely we'll have you back on very soon, okay?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And everyone, take care. Have a great day. Have a great week, and talk to you soon. Bye.